continues to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady, talk about his condition of body and mind, doctor's opinion, which accompanies it. Keep his attention focused mainly on your personal experience. See, Bill went around talking about spiritual experiences with the first 70-some-odd people he tried to work with, and none of them got sober. And Dr. Silkworth got along with him and said, look, you've got to give him the problem first. You've got to lay this obsession of the mind and allergy of the body on them and insanity and death. That's to get their attention. You've got to get on that first. And then you can tell them the rest of it. Explain that many are doomed who never realize their predicament. I cannot tell the truth from the false, and if not careful, I will drink myself to death right in front of you. Doctors are rightly loath to tell alcoholic patients the whole truth unless it will serve some good purpose. The doctors won't even say you're alcoholic. I mean, it's really interesting. They like to get them to tell them that they're alcoholics from a professional idea. But it's just interesting. There's a famous guy, Bob Pearson. I can use his name. He gave me permission. Bob Pearson was ran the general office in New York. I've got a great interview with him and his wife, Betsy. It came in 1961. And they ended up having to go see a very famous... He's a guy, he's the last story in the big book. He had two esophageal hemorrhages, and people usually do not survive the first one. And so they had the second one. He's surviving the second one. He asked the nurse how many people survive these things. And so he said to him, oh, you're the first one we've ever had that ever survived even one. He said, we don't think you can survive this one. So when he starts, yeah, they do. They get you up finally, get you walking as quick as possible, and they get him up, and he's doing pretty good, and he's quit bleeding from the throat. The veins in the throat are the weakest place. That's why they break. That's why you have esophageal hemorrhages. And usually you'll bleed out if you're not careful. You can't put a tourniquet on your throat. So he gets out of bed, and as soon as he gets out of bed, they let him walk around in his little old pajamas. He just walks himself right down to the liquor store and buys him a little vodka. And he comes back, and he loves to call his wife when he's drinking for some reason. He said, I never could figure out how she knew. And so he gets a little snootful and calls her up to, you know, and she calls the doctor, said he's drinking. The doctor's a friend. The doctor gets mad, says, I can't, your wife may have to put up with this, but I don't. And you know, he said, well, what are you going to do with me? He said, I'm going to send you to a specialist. That guy's name was Dr. Harry Tebow. Dr. Tebow, in our history, is a prominent doctor who gave his all, along with Silkworth and some number of others. So they took him to Silkworth's office, to Tebow's office, who was had in the same building the other doctor had. And he says to her, after talking to him, he says, I can't help you. And he tells his wife, he is surrounded by semen, and I can't crack through it. He'll die before I can ever find out what's going on. But I know some people that can help him. And he looks at Bob and he said, would you like me to give you the number? So I'm like, no, I don't want to put my problems on somebody else. And Bob said later in life, he remembered the guy reached over and called the number. He had it by memory. And he got his first sponsor. And the guy drove up in a Porsche at the top down. He was a lawyer for the city. And he had a handlebar mustache. He was quite a flamboyant guy with a scarf that flew out the back when they drove down the road and gave him a scarf and took him to his first meeting. Never had a drink since. Isn't that amazing? That's amazing. You may talk to him about the hopelessness of alcoholism because you offer a solution. How you like that one? If you have no solution, what good is it to talk about it? It's like standing over the cancer bed. Let's talk about your cancer. Boy, you look terrible today. Look at how yellow you're being. I think talking about a solution, you can talk to them about the hopelessness of this thing. If you don't have a solution and you're in some doctor's office and he's got no solution, all he's going to do is talk about hopelessness, I'm going to come out of there terrible. I'm right. He's right. I'm hopeless. But you offer a solution. And that's what makes us different than anybody else in the world. I heard a guy the other day in a meeting. I'm really glad to hear this kind of stuff. He said, this is not a therapy. Alcoholics Anonymous is not therapy. You will soon have your friends admitting he has many, if not all, of the traits of the alcoholic. If his own doctor is willing to tell him that he's alcoholic, so much the better. Yeah, from time to time, you get one to say so. Even though you're, now he's a protege. How do you like, he's moving up, right? He's a protege. He's your pal, you know. He's a guy that follows you around to the meetings, you know. Come on, Mike, we're going to the meeting. Man. Confrontation without solution is brutality. You might want to write that in the book. Confrontation without solution is brutality. We all got it? Confrontation without solution is brutality. Would you think it was brutality if you went up to Napa, four or five people, and started picking on the schizophrenic? You're going to be here the rest of your life. Ha, 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 ha. Yeah, you really messed up, aren't you? No solution. You got to be. We have something we can offer people. We have a solution. So he said he has become very met his condition. He has become very curious to know how you got well. Then he's wanting the leading question. What do I have to do? Oh boy, I'm ready. Tell him exactly. Let him ask you that question, if he will. Tell him exactly what happened to you. Stress the spiritual feature freely. Don't back up on God. If the man be agnostic or atheist, make it emphatic that he does not have to agree with your conception of God. Yes, that's true. If he can choose any conception he likes, provided it makes sense to him. The main thing is that he be willing to believe in a power greater than himself and that he live by spiritual principles. He doesn't have to identify that power. When dealing with such a person, you had better use everyday language to describe spiritual principles. There's no use arousing any prejudice he may have against your theological terms and conceptions about which he's already confused. Don't raise such issues, no matter what your own convictions are. Oh, change the name on you. Your prospect may become a religious... may come from a religious denomination, his religious education and training may be far superior to yours. In that case, he's going to wonder how you can add anything to what he already knows. But he will be curious to learn why his own convictions have not worked. Roland Hazard, on his second visit to Carl Jung, says to Jung, Jung said to him, I've never been successful with an alcoholic of your kind. I misdiagnosed you. And the only out I think that you have is you get yourself a bodyguard or lock yourself up. Roland hit the bottom. He's not stupid. And he says it felt like the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. And he's just standing there, demoralized, you know. Is there nothing, though? Is there nothing? I'm desperate now. Is there nothing? Here's one of the greatest minds. I have all the faith in this guy. Can't help me. Where am I going now? Can't see Freud. He's all messed up. So he says, is there nothing else? And the old doctor says, he doesn't understand it. He says, but from time to time, he says, people have had spiritual experiences. They've changed their life. He said, you know, to me, these are phenomena. I can't explain them to you from a doctor's training. I'm an MD and a psychiatrist. I can't explain it to you. So Roland gets real desperate and he said, oh, well, after all, I'm a good church member. Well, I'm bright enough to do that. You don't have to be a psychiatrist of that nature. Roland, yeah, that's right, but you're still a drunk, Roland. You're going to church, but you're still a drunk. You know, you got to find something else. And, of course, Roland, we know what happened. He found the Oxford group. So, then he worked with Ebby. So your prospect, we did that, already knows. He will be curious to learn why his own convictions have not worked and why yours seem to work so well. He may be an example of the truth that faith alone is insufficient. To be vital, life-sustaining, vital, Faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and unselfishness. Constructive action. Service. Service, service, service. We practice these principles in all of our affairs. It's how I stay out of me. Out of me. Let him see that you are not there to instruct him in religion. Admit he probably knows more about it than you do. Famous story of Bill on the wet 12-step call of a Catholic guy. But call his attention to the fact, however deep his faith and knowledge, he could not have applied it or he would not have drank. That's right. Full of religion. I love the priests that come in, you know. Full of religion and drunk. Nothing like good Baptist preacher coming in, drunk, you know. Perhaps your story will help him see where he has failed to practice the very precepts he knows so well. Here's where we come from. We represent no particular faith or denomination. We're dealing only with general principles common to most denominations. So where do we come from? Where do our principles come from? They come from the common denominations of that day. Are you sitting here waiting to go to work? All righty, here we go. If when you look at the books and it talks about faith or denominations, we're dealing only with general principles common to most denominations, this book, Bill, accredits to Dr. Shoemaker of the Calvary Mission. He's an Episcopal priest. He says he's the influence for this book. He will, after Ebby fades on him and is not around, his sponsor became a guy who called a spiritual advisor by the name of Father Ed Dowling. You can read a book called, and there is that list back there. I see that somebody came up. I bought that list up. It's a great book called The Soul of Sponsorship. It is a wonderful book called The Soul, S-O-U-L, of Sponsorship. And if you find that list, it'll tell you where to look for it on the Internet. You can order these books. But it's a great relationship. When you get to this book, you're going to find it's going to be saying things like, seven deadly sins. You don't find that over here. Sins of omission and commission. That's very Catholic. So there's some influence. Bill will take the lessons in the Catholic Church. He won't stay with them, but he took the lessons. All right. Now you're down to taking some action with this guy because he has now said he would like to do something. And they're not backing up at all here. They lay it out. You got to come to him with depth and weight. You can't come at an alcoholic with baloney. So he says, outline the program of action. 1 through 12. Tell him what he's going to have to do. Explain how you made a self-appraisal, 4. Of how you straightened out your past, 8 and 9. And why you're now endeavoring to be helpful to him, 12. It's important for him to realize that your attempts to pass this on to him plays a vital part in your own recovery. Actually, he may be helping you more than you're helping him, and that is the absolute truth. I made lots of 12-step calls that didn't work, but I'm still sober. Make it plain he's under no obligation to you, that you hope only that he will try to help other alcoholics when he escapes his own difficulties. So I take the two promises. Go on wet 12-step calls with me night or day and work with others when the time comes. See, I know it's coming, so I just tell them out front. Suggest how important it is that he place the welfare of other people ahead of his own. Absolutely. I told you about that today. Make it clear that he is not under pressure, that he needn't see you again if he doesn't want to. You should not be offended if he wants to call it off, for he has helped you more than you've helped him. If your talk's been sane, quiet, and full of human understanding, you have perhaps made a friend. Maybe you have disturbed him about the question of alcoholism. This is all to the good. The more hopeless he feels, the better. He will be more likely to follow your suggestions. Now he's going to call him another name. Your candidate. May give reasons why he need not follow all of the program. Oh boy. My sponsor says, I wish they'd never put the steps on the wall. He may rebel at the thought of a drastic house cleaning, step 4, which requires discussion with other people, step 5. Do not contradict such views. Tell him that you once felt as he does, but you doubt whether you would have made much progress had you not taken action. On your first visit, tell him about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Tell him that we meet, group of us. If he shows interest, lend him a copy of this book. Mine's too marked up for study. I'll give him a new one. Let him do his own study. Unless your friend wants to talk further about himself, do not wear out your welcome. That's an important thing to do. Give him a chance to think it over. If you do not stay, let him steer the conversation in any direction he likes. Sometimes a new man is anxious to proceed at once, and you may be tempted to let him do so. This sometimes is a mistake. If he has trouble later, he is likely to say you rushed him. You will be more successful with alcoholics if you do not exhibit any passion for crusader reform. Never talk down to an alcoholic from any moral or spiritual hilltop. Simply lay out the kit of spiritual tools for his inspection. Steps 1 through 12. Show him how they worked with you. This is how you sponsor. Offer him friendship and fellowship. Tell him that if he wants to get well, you will do anything to help. That's absolutely true. If he's not interested in your solution, if he expects you to act only as a banker for his financial difficulties or nurse or his sprees, you may have to drop him until he changes his mind. Some people might call this tough love. This he may do after he gets hurt some more. Pain is the price of admission here. The flamethrowers on the cheeks of my butt that drove me through them doors was alcohol. Wasn't you. Didn't know you, didn't care to know you. If he is sincerely interested and wants to see you again, ask him to read this book in the interval. After doing that, he must decide for himself whether he wants to go on. He should not be pushed or prodded by you, his wife, or his friends. If he is to find God, the desire must come from within. It is unnatural for the soul to be separated from that which created it. It's just as unnatural for the child to be separated from the parent. Very painful. Ask parents whose children die before they do. Terrible thing. If he thinks he can do the job in some other way or prefers some other spiritual approach, encourage him to follow his own conscience. I am big on that. Please go out and get everything out of the way. Get it all done. Try S for a while. That don't work. Well, all right, let's go over and do this. You know, let's find something more. Get it all. If I'd had one more good idea, I'd be dead. I mean, I had to find that kind of bottom. You know. We have no monopoly on God. We don't. And people do recover in other ways. We just happen to be... I had some guy talking in a meeting that Mike and I, and he kind of went after me a little bit. We talked about God a lot here, and I'm an atheist, and I, and sort of all this stuff. So he couldn't draw me in, but I can tell you this. Of all the recovery in the world today, including the medical and the psychiatric, and all 12-step programs around, of all kinds, with all kinds of deals, no one even gets close to us. No one has ever even got close. Hospitals produce about 3%. No one has ever got close. Think about that for a minute. Never, they don't even get close to us. Amazing. He said, we merely have an approach that works with us. This is a voluntary, totally voluntary thing. I want to go back to that line. Where he talks about the desire must come from within. Have you ever thought about that for yourself? Have you ever thought about why you stayed and they didn't? Because I know you know lots of them that didn't. Have you ever thought about that? Someone was handing out why we were chosen today. But that's a tremendous statement. They're talking about the spirit from within. They're talking about your soul. They're talking about the essence of your life. That's deep stuff. I mean, I wish I could give you a beautiful explanation. I can't. But I'm talking about this is beyond, beyond. And they recognized it. I don't know. I just knew when I came here that I'd had enough. And I didn't know I could quit drinking. I found you people. I thought you were marvelous then, and I think you're marvelous now. You are the first place in my life that I ever fit. Does that make sense? Do you feel that way? I fit here. I've never tired of it. I got tired of a lot of it. I've been president of unions. I've done a lot of stuff in my life. Never, never have I ever tired of this. And I never tire of hearing the story of recovery coming out of the lips of somebody that's the speaker of that day that didn't have to drink that day. I've never tired of that story. Oh, man. But point out that we alcoholics have much in common that we would like in case to be friendly and let it go at that. Do not discourage if you're... Well, let's see. I'll do that and then I'll let Mike talk a while. There's a big joke here. I'll tell you what it is. This lady, our sponsor, he went to her and she says, I've never had sex sober, the sponsor to the... And our sex indicates that we really need to work this out with God, and no human being really can do this. Maybe some old-timer that's been around and married, and, you know. So anyway, she tells her to go to page 69 and read about sex. By the time she gets home that evening, she got the numbers backwards, and she goes to 96. So let's see what she read about sex. It says, do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. That's kind of clever, isn't it? Search out another alcoholic, try again. You're sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. I like that. We may find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. To spend too much time on any one situation is to deny some other alcoholic of an opportunity to live and be happy. One of our fellowship failed entirely with his first half a dozen prospects. He often says if he had continued to work on them, he might have deprived many others who have since recovered of their chance. Suppose now you're making your second visit to a man. He has read this volume and says he's prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. Having had the experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. That's all sponsors do. They just walk with you as you take the steps with some experience with God. Let him know you are available if he wishes to make a decision, called step 3. And tell his story, 4 and 5. But do not insist upon it if he prefers to consult someone else. We will try anything but God. Just anything. Are you ready, Mike? Fire up, kid.
So he may be broke and homeless. If he is, you might try to help him about getting a job or give him a little financial assistance. But you should not deprive your family or creditors of money they should have. Perhaps you won't take this man into your home for a few days, but be sure you use discretion. Be sure he'll be welcomed by your family and that he is not trying to impose upon you for money, connections, or shelter. Permit that and you only harm him. You will be making it possible for him to be insincere. You may be aiding his destruction rather than his recovery. It's so easy when you first start, for me, I got to tell you, it's just my story. I first start sponsoring and it's like, I want to do everything I can to help. I'm going to save the world. You know, my ego's coming back into the thing, and these are like my babies. You know, and next thing you know, I'm performing a service function instead of a sponsor's function. You know, there's a level at which you can do everything, and your own experience will tell you that. But I often get sponsees when the question is, well, I just need a little money. I just need to, like, get a place to stay, and I'll be okay. If I just get, like, $100 in my pocket, I'll be all right. You know, I just need some connections. You need to help me get a job. That's not what I do. I'm your sponsor. I'm back up here on the two paragraphs back up the page. My job is to be available if you wish to make a decision or tell your story. So it says, back on page 97, never avoid these responsibilities. Be sure you are doing the right thing if you assume them. Helping others is a foundation stone of your recovery. A kindly act once in a while isn't enough. You have to act a good Samaritan every day if need be. It may mean the loss of many nights' sleep, great interference with your pleasures, interruptions to your business. It may mean sharing your money in your home, counseling frantic wives and relatives, innumerable trips to police courts, sanitariums, hospitals, jails, and asylums. Your phone may jangle at any time of night or day. Your wife may sometimes say she's neglected. A drunk may smash the furniture in your home or burn a mattress. You may have a fight with him if he is violent. Sometimes you may have to call a doctor and administrators under his direction. Another time you may have to send for the police or an ambulance. Occasionally you will have to meet such conditions. Now remember, this is 1939 when the book came out. There's no treatment centers. There's no detox. There's no hospital that wants to take drunks. The people at this time in the history of AA are, in fact, serving as detox centers, taking drugs at home, doing all these kind of things. It's not as prevalent anymore, but my experience is that I have been in that position. I have taken sponsees into my home. I have supplied them with a little money. I have tried to do what I can do to help a sponsee, and it becomes a very gray area between when am I stepping over that line and when am I not. So it says, we seldom allow an alcoholic to live in our homes for long at a time. It's not good for them. It sometimes creates serious complications in the family. So an alcoholic does not respond, there is no reason why you should neglect his family. You should continue to be friendly with him. The family should be offered your way of life. Should they accept and practice spiritual principles, there is much better chance that the head of the family will recover. And even though he continues to drink, the family will find life more bearable. Once again, this was before Al-Anon. Al-Anon wasn't in place at the time that the book was written. And at that time, those sponsoring an AA were dealing with families a whole lot more than they do today. But it still doesn't mean that when you're sponsoring that you're not going to have that occasion, as Don was talking about earlier, where a mother or a sister or a wife or somebody is going to be calling you saying, you're a sponsor, why isn't this guy getting well? You know, why aren't you doing what you need to be doing, you know? And it's difficult to say, you know, I'm just a sponsor. But you can also counsel him on our way of life. You know, that this is a program that requires participation on the part of the alcoholic. For the type of alcoholic who is able and willing to get well, that's a very conditional qualification for that guy or girl who is able and willing to get well, little charity in the ordinary sense the word is needed or wanted. Men who cry for money and shelter before conquering alcohol are on the wrong track. Yet we do go to great extremes to provide each other with these very things when such action is warranted. This may seem inconsistent, but we think it is not. Once again, I'm drawing the line. I have to look at each situation. I need to judge what's taking place here. And if I've got a sponsee that's saying, no, I'm not interested in doing these steps. I'm not interested in reading the book until I get back to my job and I get a roof over my head. I'm not going to do these things. And my experience at the Salvation Army and elsewhere, but particularly the Salvation Army, is once you get in there, you got four walls around you, you got food, and you got a shelter, and you know, they don't pay you very much, but you're safe. Then all of a sudden, my need, you know, what I needed and wanted is I got this basic necessities done. My enthusiasm for being able and willing to get well start drifting away. I need you to be at your bottom. You know, that's my judgment. Am I bottomed out? And am I working a program? And am I moving forward? Then it can make some sense for me. I got to tell you, Don can verify, I spent a lot of time when I first started sponsoring. I'm on the phone with Don. Oh, this guy really needs some help. I really got to do something for him. I can't, don't know what I'm going to do. And, you know, next thing I know, we're not working steps anymore. We're talking about the Bank of Mike. You know, we're talking about, why don't you come over and see me today and let's go have lunch. And you're buying. So it's not a matter of giving, back in the book, that's not a matter of giving that is in question, but when and how to give. That often makes the difference between failure and success. Very important line. The minute we put our work on the service plane, the alcoholic commences to rely on our assistance rather than upon God. Wow. See, that's what was so great about working when Don had me start going to the Salvation Army and all the years I've been there is that I understand they're a service organization. You know, that what they want to do is feed and house and clothe and provide a service for people that are indigent and that are alcoholics and addicts. And I let them do the service part. Now, they think they're taking them to God, and that's okay. They can think that. I also come in there, but I'm in there to take them on the program. And that helps me to finally understand what that is, because when I meet somebody just at a meeting, I wanted, you know, I start thinking I'm the Salvation Army. Or I'm, you know, what is it, the Sisters of Charity, or the Poor Sisters of the Poor, or the Catholic Charities Foundation, or, you know, somebody else. I mean, that's not our job. That's not what a sponsor is supposed to do. He clamors for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for. Nonsense. Long sentence. Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn this truth. Thank you very much. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence upon God. Well, I can't. As much as I want to, I can't go play God again. Burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean house. That's my job as a sponsor, to help someone on the path to their understanding of their relationship with their God, so that they can recover the way that through the spiritual experience of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now the domestic problem. There may be divorce, separation, or just strained relations. When your prospect has made such reparation as he can to his family and has thoroughly explained to them the new principles by which he is living, he should proceed to put these principles into action at home. That is, if he is lucky enough to have a home. Though his family be at fault in many respects, he should not be concerned about that. He should concentrate on his own spiritual demonstration. Argument and fault-finding are to be avoided like the plague. In many homes, this is a difficult thing to do, but it must be done if any results are to be expected. If persisted in for a few months, the effect on a man's family is sure to be great. The most incompatible people discover they have a basis upon which they can meet. Little by little, the family may see their own defects and admit them. These can then be discussed in an atmosphere of helpfulness and friendliness. See, I can't. My program comes first. My sponsees, it's like, you know, I've got this problem with my family. I got this problem with my kids. I need to go work on my job. You don't need to do anything. Except get sober and work these steps and find a relationship with God as you understand God, so then you can be of use to somebody else. It doesn't matter, job or no job, wife or no wife. If I'm not a sober person, I'm not going anywhere. There's nothing else to solve. There's no reparation to be made. I can't make restitution for anything. Because I'm still going to be living in the problem, not living in the solution. After they've seen tangible results, the family will perhaps want to go along. These things will come to pass naturally and in good time, provided, however, the alcoholic continues to demonstrate that he can be sober, considerate, and helpful, regardless of what anyone says or does. That's all I have to do. You are my sponsee, I'm telling you. Sober, considerate, helpful, regardless of what anyone else says or does. Of course, we all fall much below this standard many times. Right, I'm not going to get there. But that's the standard. But we must try to repair the damage immediately, lest we pay the penalty with a spree. The danger isn't that I can't ever get back. See, I start thinking that I'm not going to get back something. I start living in the past. You know, I want to go back and recreate something. I want to recover something. Well, guess what? What I did, I've done. I cannot change the past. And my fourth step, you know, and new guys coming in, it's like, boy, I think I'm going to be able to go back here and, like, fix this. No. That damage is done. Those harms are done. That is behind you. And all you can do is clean house and straighten that out as best you can, but only if you've gotten through the steps. So if I'm going to sit here in a sponsee-sponsor relationship and you're going to continue to tell me about all of the problems and issues that you have, I'm going to continue to tell you that you better go to God with those. Because I got to go to the solution. I got to bring my sponsees out of being in the problem. Like the book said, your problems are nonsense. Our problems, we think, are of our own making. I think that's what it says back there on about page 62. If there be divorce or separation, there should be no undue haste for the couple to get together. The man should be sure of his recovery. The wife should fully understand his new way of life. If their old relationship is to be resumed, it must be on a better basis since the former did not work. This means a new attitude and spirit all around. Sometimes it is to the best interest of all concerned that a couple remain apart. Obviously, no rule can be laid down. Let the alcoholic continue his program day by day. When the time for living together has come, it will be apparent to both parties. Why am I going to go back and become the director and try to figure out how I'm going to put relationships back together when I could never do it in the beginning? Why am I going to not look at doing the 12 steps and I'm going to think that somehow I have control over the fact that I can change somebody else's life? No. There's no rule to be laid down. We just let it continue day by day, and when the time for living together has come, it will be apparent to both parties. It's not a one-way street. I never understood relationships in the first place. Why am I all of a sudden, I haven't had a drink for a week, and I'm smart? Let no alcoholic say he cannot recover unless he has his family back. This just isn't so. In some cases, the wife will never come back for one reason or another. Remind the prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people. It is dependent upon his relationship with God. We have seen men get well whose families have not returned at all. We have seen others slip when the family came back too soon. Oh, I can't control this. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. See, I'm walking with the sponsee. We are walking hand in hand, but we're not walking towards what we want. We're walking towards a spiritual relationship. We're walking to get closer to God as we understand God. If you persist, and these are promises, if you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. See, I love it. I got guys. I just love them to death. I got through the steps, Mike. I've done some of my amends, but you know what? I met the most beautiful woman. And I think this is really it. But Bob, you're like in step 8. You haven't made a single amends in step 9. Don't you think you ought to wait till 9's over and you cleaned up some wreckage of your past before you start creating wreckage in the future? Oh, no. I have a relationship. My phone rings and somebody starts out, I have a new relationship. I say, talk to God, call me later. You see, I can go from wreckage to wreckage to wreckage. And what it's saying here is I've got to be on a path of spiritual progress. I got to find my spiritual well-being before I start going back to all those other things. So it says, when working with a man and his family, you should take care not to participate in their quarrels. That happens all the time. I'm not party. It's none of my business. My only business I have is to walk with another man to a relationship with God of his understanding. You may spoil your chance of being helpful if you do, but urge upon a man's family that he has been a very sick person and should be treated accordingly. You should warn against arousing resentment or jealousy. You should point out that his defects of character are not going to disappear overnight. Show them that he has entered upon a period of growth. Ask them to remember, when they are impatient, the blessed fact of his sobriety. If you have been successful in solving your own domestic problems, tell the newcomer's family how that was accomplished. In this way, you can set them on the right track without becoming critical of them. The story of how you and your wife settled your difficulty is worth any amount of criticism. I'm only ever speaking to my own experience. That's what the book's telling us here. I don't go one inch beyond my own experience. You know? If I got a sponsee that, if I'm single and I got a sponsee that's married and he comes to me and says, geez, how did you make things better with your wife? Or how can I make things better with my wife? It's very difficult for me to say, you know what I think? I'll give you some advice. But I've never done it. You know, people come to me and they want advice about it. I said, well, are you serious? I couldn't follow my own advice. I don't have advice. But if I have an experience that I can relate, that's tied to the solution, that's tied to the program, then I've got something to share. Assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. People have said we must not go where liquor is served, we must not have it in our homes, we must shun friends who drink, we must avoid moving pictures for drink which show drinking scenes, we must not go into bars, our friends must hide their bottles if we go into their houses, we mustn't think or be reminded of alcohol at all. Our experience shows that this is not necessarily so. Step 10 told us, right? Remember the promises of step 10. You know, we cease fighting anyone and anything, particularly alcohol. It's been removed. Happened automatically. It says, we meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. There is something the matter with his spiritual status. His only chance for sobriety would be someplace like the Greenland ice cap, and even there, an Eskimo might turn up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. Ask any woman who has sent her husband to a distant place on the theory he would escape the alcohol problem. In our belief, any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield a sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. If the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but he usually winds up with a bigger explosion than ever. We have tried these methods. These attempts to do the impossible have always failed. So our rule is not to avoid a place where there is drinking if we have a legitimate reason for being there. That includes bars, nightclubs, dances, receptions, weddings, and even plain ordinary whoopee parties. To a person who has had experience with an alcoholic, this may seem tempting providence, but it isn't. If I have done the steps, if I have got the promises that are in 10, if I'm doing 11 and living in 12, then it's gone. The problem has been removed. I love it. Sometimes you're in the meeting and somebody says, what's the topic for the meeting today? Sometimes you get those discussion meetings like, let's talk about triggers. Well, what's a trigger? I mean, what's a trigger for me? You know, that's a cycle bout. I don't have a trigger. You know, I don't have to trigger something that's on a gun. But it's got nothing to do with alcohol, because if I worked the steps and done the program, the obsession's been removed. If I'm still thinking that I've got a craving, you know, I mean, Dr. Bob went 2.5 years after he got sober and said, I still had a craving. He kept working with others. You know, if I'm doing that, then I got to go work with some others. I got to find out what he just said right here. That is a spiritual. There's something the matter with his spiritual status. I need to go back and look at the spiritual solution that I've applied to this problem. You will note that we made an important qualification. Therefore, we ask ourselves on each occasion, have I any good social, business, or personal reason for going to this place? Or am I expecting to steal a little vicarious pleasure from the atmosphere of such places? If you answer these questions satisfactorily, you need have no apprehension. Go or stay away. Whichever seems best. But be sure you are on solid spiritual ground before you start, and that your motive in going is thoroughly good. I want my motives. I've got to look at my motives. I'm going to do what we talked about in step 11. If I'm agitated, I'm going to pause. Before I take this action, I'm going to ask the question. You see, there's a thought that precedes every action. And if I have that thought, and I think, wow, is this the right thing to do? Then I'm going to stop and ask the question. That's what step 11 told me to do. Before, when I was drinking, there was no gap between thought, action, consequence. They just ran together in a heartbeat. I want it. I want it now. I'm going to do it. And I don't care what happens. Bang, 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 bang. You know. Now I say, wow, I'm going to stop. I'm going to ask myself the question. Do I have a reason? I'm going to stick between my thought and my action. I'm going to insert the program Alcoholics Anonymous, but primarily when I'm inserting there is my relationship with God. I'm saying, God, I'm going to go here. Are you going to go with me? My brother does that really well. He asks a question. He always says, I don't like to pray a whole lot, but I always find I'm ready to make a decision. I got to stop and say, wait. Okay, God, I'm getting ready to go do this thing, and I want you to hold my hand and go along with me. Are you going to go there or not? Sometimes the answer is yes, and sometimes the answer is no, and sometimes there's no answer at all. So he just figures out, as long as he's choosing to take the responsibility, if it's no, that he's going to be in trouble. See, I got to ask the question. So what does he say to do? Be sure you're on solid spiritual ground before you start, and your motive in going is thoroughly good. Right. Do not think of what you will get out of the occasion. Think of what you can bring to it. See, I'm always got to not think about self, think about others. But if you were shaky, this is the one I love, because every time in this book, there's something wrong with me, what do? You'd better work with another alcoholic instead. Well, I sit with a long face in places where there's drinking, sighing about the good old days. If it is a happy occasion, try to increase the pleasure of those there. If a business occasion, go and attend to your business enthusiastically. If you are with a person who wants to eat at a bar, in a bar, by all means go along. Let your friends know they are not to change their habits on your account. At a proper time and place, explain to all your friends why alcohol disagrees with you. When you were drinking, you were withdrawing from life little by little. Now, you are getting back into the social life of this world. Don't start to withdraw again just because your friends drink liquor. Your job, now we're back to remember, we have a new employer. So your job, my job, now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand. Keep on the firing line of life with these motives and God will keep you unharmed. I had somebody today tell me a story about somebody called up and they were stuck in a barn. They're getting ready to be in trouble. What were we going to do? And it's like, well, if you're really in trouble, I'll drive down and I'll get you out of the bar. I'm not staying in the bar. I'm not doing anything in the bar. But I'll come down and help you out of the bar. You know, one of my guys calls me up and says, it's trouble. I'm in trouble. I'm in this crack house down here in West Oakland. Can you come down here and like bail me out? I'm ready. Fine. I'll drive down and I'll get you. I'm not going to like hang around and watch. But I can go to the most sordid place on earth. If I'm going to do God's will, if I have the direction that that's what I'm supposed to be doing, then I'm safe. That's my experience. So you keep on the firing line of life with these motives and God will keep you unharmed. That's a huge promise. You know, if I'm doing what I said I was going to do in three, if I'm getting everything I need because I'm staying close to my God and I'm doing God's work and God just told me, the book just told me this is my job, then I can go do that job and I don't have to worry. I know what my job is now. So it says, many of us keep liquor in our homes. We often need it to carry green recruits through the severe hangover, Some of us still serve it to our friends, provided they are not alcoholic. But some of us think we should not serve liquor to anyone. We never argue this question. We feel that each family, in the light of their own circumstances, ought to decide for themselves. Once again, AA doesn't have a rule. You know, what's safe for you? Some families, I got some families that can't have anything in the house. You know, some people keep, you know, they'll keep stuff in the house. I can find what's comfortable. And not only what's comfortable for me as alcoholic, what's comfortable with those people that are around me all the time, every day. We're careful never to show intolerance or hatred of drinking as an institution. Remember back in 4 and 5, I turned off my judgment machine. No, I can't go. If I'm showing intolerance or hatred of drinking as an institution, why not? You know, I'm building up a resentment. You know, I'm like feeling that self-pity. Poor me. I wish I could be normal. You know, the fact is, I never wanted to be normal. Somebody said to me once, she said, geez, if you could drink like a normal person, wouldn't that be great? And I thought about it. I said, ooh, no, I wouldn't want to drink like a normal person. If I can't drink like I drink, I don't want to drink. So experience shows that such an attitude is not helpful to anyone. Right. Because I don't have intolerance and I don't have hatred. And I don't even have that of the institution of drinking. Because all I know, drinking wasn't my problem. I'm my problem. Alcohol's for the symptom. Not a symptom for everybody else that's still out there drinking. So why would I be intolerant? Experience shows such an attitude is not helpful to anyone. Every new alcoholic looks for this spirit among us and is immensely relieved when he finds we are not witch burners. It's so important for a newcomer coming into the room to understand that they're not going to be judged and they're not going to be told that they're doing the wrong thing. A spirit of intolerance might repel alcoholics whose lives could have been saved had it not been for such stupidity. We would not even do the cause of temperate drinking any good, for not one drinker in 1,000 likes to be told anything about alcohol by one who hates it. Someday we hope that Alcoholics Anonymous will help the public to a better realization of the gravity of the alcoholic problem, but we shall be of little use if our attitude is one of bitterness and hostilities. Drinkers will not stand for it. After all, our problems were of our own making. Bottles were only a symbol. Besides, we have stopped fighting anybody or anything. We have to.